Children are dismissed. Take out your Bible and turn to Revelation chapter 3. Find verse 13. Pardon me, verse 7. There's a little outline in your bulletin you're welcome to follow along with. Let me make a quick announcement. Linda and her parents left Sanibel Island in Florida, where they were seemed like the center of that hurricane dropped in and pretty much destroyed their living accommodations. And they are in Southern Georgia, about 6 hours from here. John needs to drive over there tomorrow and needs someone to drive him over there so he can drive back. They can drive back two cars. And if you're available to drive over there, they'll accommodate you for the evening if you need and come back the next day. It's about a six-hour drive there and probably 6 hours back. If you can use your own car, great. I think John will let you use his if possible. But if you can do that tomorrow, John would really appreciate it. It makes their transport back over here. His in-laws are coming with Linda just to relocate and try to figure out their next step. They have a mess to clean up. They can't get back to their house. It's just destroyed. It's drowning in 4 feet of water or whatever. So if you can help with that, please see John afterwards. He doesn't have a lot of options, and that would be a really good one if he could resolve that problem tomorrow morning, okay? He did not ask me to make that announcement. I just decided to take matters into my own hands, okay? All right, Revelation chapter 3 and verse 7. Let me read the text to you. This is the sixth letter. We have seven total. We'll be done next week, Lord willing. Verse 7, and to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, the words of the Holy One, the true One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one opens. I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door, which no one is able to shut. I know that you have but little power, and yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. Behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews and are not, but lie. Behold, I will make them come and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. Because you have kept my word about patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world, to try those who dwell on earth. I am coming soon. Hold fast what you have, so that no one may seize your crown. The one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it. And I will write on him the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down from God, my God out of heaven, and my own new name. He who has ears, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. As it has been my pattern, let's review Philadelphia, this little place. The city was founded in 140 BC and named after its founder, Attalus, who was known as Philadelphos, which means a city of brotherly love. The geography of this town is really important. The city was named for the brotherly love between Attalus and his brother, Eumenes. The city has an old settlement. Began as an old settlement and was strategically located between the borders of three countries, Mysia, Lydia, and Phrygia. They were separate country areas in that particular, strategically located in those three areas. It was flanked by a highway that led from the east all the way into Europe. It literally stood on the border between two continents. When the city was founded, it was intended as a missionary outpost to the wilds of Phrygia for the advance of Greek culture called Hellenism. Alexander the Great was an interesting character, but he really wanted to push the Greek culture into the world. And that was called Hellenism. What is it? Our New Testament was originally written in Greek. Why do you suppose that is? Because Alexander the Great made speaking Greek the common language of commerce. So everybody who traded apples or potatoes had to know Greek. So why not write the New Testament in a language that everybody understood? So Hellenism, as much as there was negative and all that hero stuff and Zeus and whatnot and all those temples and everything else, all that pagan nonsense, it did give us one thing. It gave us the Greek language, which the New Testament's written in. Not just what they call High Greek, but Common Greek. Okay, so Hellenism had its positive pieces to it. Sardis was established in much the same way as Lydia to advance Hellenism over the continent, over the country of Turkey, what we know today. So they were brotherly in that sense. However, the Philadelphians were not very cooperative, and they pushed back against this Hellenist cultural invasion. Thus the word open door in this text a couple of times. Reflecting on the past of Philadelphia, would they be an open door for Hellenism, or as this letter uses the term, would they open their hearts to this way of thinking? Culture. The second geographic piece on there is a thing called burnt land. Now, that's not in the text, but it describes the area, the geographic area. The city was on the edge of a place called the burnt land, a vast volcanic region that produced some of the most fertile land in the world. I was living in Southern California, and Mount St. Helens blew over, and the result of that was devastating. But guess what? Farmers were growing stuff like crazy because volcanic ash is such a rich thing to grow things in. It was famous for wine and had an abundance of hot springs that were used in the medical world. These two things resulted in many exports to the known world, and many also came seeking medical relief and healing. The location was not all roses because the volcanic activity also meant earthquakes. And in 17 AD, an earthquake rocked the area. It actually destroyed 12 cities. And the two worst hit were Philadelphia and Sardis, the city we covered last week. So they got destroyed. Well, this was Rome's opportunity to engage themselves. So they rebuilt both of those cities, making the people in those cities owe them. They were completely grateful to Rome for rebuilding the city. One final reference is found in its primary crop for exports were grapes. They loved their wine and they were committed to and worshipped Dionysus, the god of wine. When someone was faithful to life in Philadelphia, they were honored by having their name placed on one of the pillars in these many temples. So this was a big deal. So when people walked into the temple, they saw your name on this pillar. But look back at the end of the text right there. What does John tell the people of Philadelphia who are faithful? The one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. And I will write my name on those pillars. So there's some distinct connections between what's going on in this text and the people who read this letter. I know what he's talking about. Oh, so he takes the geographical situation and does something with it. So what do I learn from that? I don't think I put this in your outline, but just jot this down. We may think that history and geography are circumstantial, but nothing is so haphazard in God's creation. Nothing. I'm reading a fascinating book right now, and it's written by a geopoliticist. And I just read a section in the past 2 days about where are all the elements that we need in manufacturing? Where are they located? And if there is a country in the world that can sustain itself based upon its natural resources and its ability to move things from point A to point B, guess where that country is? Right under our feet. And the countries that lack all those things are distance from here. China is the worst place in the world to live for natural resources. They have some, but it's the worst place to live, to move things about. And we live in the very best place on the face of the earth, hands down. There are four countries that have the natural resources to kind of carry things on if the world kind of goes crazy. This is the best place to live. Philadelphia had a few things going for it, but there were volcanoes and earthquakes and all the stuff that went around it in regard to that stuff. So back to what I just said, we may think that history and geography are circumstantial, but nothing is so haphazard in God's creation. And I go back to Luke chapter 12, to whom much is given, only a little is required. That's not what it says. To whom much is given, much is required. Much. God is always involved, and as we can see from this letter, there is a divine lining in all of life. We just need to listen to God and see and hear, and then we may understand what he is doing. So let's look at the text. Just kind of wander through it the way we've been doing. The Holy One, the True One. So this is the description that comes through first. Where's this come from? The first five letters, the description came out of chapter 1, verses 12 through 17. He just snags a little section out of there and drops it into the letter. This one comes out of the Old Testament. This is not part of the chapter 1. It comes out of the Old Testament. In the first five letters, Jesus introduces himself from chapter 1. Now he introduces himself from the Old Testament. When you think about the Old Testament, what's the most important thing that comes to mind about God? The New Testament, God is love, is blazing through the pages. The Old Testament, God is holy. He loves his people. Doesn't say he loves anybody else. He loves his people, the Jews. But we discover the most important thing about the Father is that he's holy. And so John, the Spirit, drops this into this particular text right here. And by the way, this letter has no negative things to say about this church. He's holy, and it touches on the Holy One, the phrasing Holy One. Read the book of Isaiah, and he takes that, the Holy One of Israel is laced through that book, speaking of God's holiness. Habakkuk 3:3 is another one. God's holiness is the central quality and nature of God revealed in the Old Testament. Isaiah chapter 6, the seraphim cry out, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts." And Jesus highlights that in this letter. As we turn to the New Testament, the title is also closely associated with Jesus in Luke chapter 1, a variety of places. And Jesus is called the Holy One by a demon in Mark chapter 1, verse 24. So even the spirit world knows that God is holy. He is the true one from the Greek word aletheos, speaking to that which is genuine, authentic, and real. That's what that word means in the Greek language, and refers to himself that way in John 14, verse 6. I am the way, the truth. I'm completely in charge of the source of all true things, all truth. That's what he's saying. In this text, it's a claim to deity and points to the call of God to be holy as I am holy, from 1 Peter 1, verse 15. The third descriptor that Jesus uses is the one he has the keys and stands at the entrance of eternity. That's what that word keys right there says, or means, refers to. If you want to walk into eternity and be blessed, take being planted in America. We just hosted five girls and two adults from an orphanage in Uganda the last 2 days. And I could tell by the looks on their faces, like, oh, wow. we're just middle-class Americans. And they're just, I was in Uganda for 6 weeks back in 2008, and there's no doubt that they would have been blown away by the lifestyle of people who live in the West. I could hear them, we're coming here. When we're big enough, we're coming here. We got to get out of wherever we are. We're coming here. This is the blessed place on the face of the earth. It just felt that way to me. Okay. They didn't say those words to me, but thinking they know how blessed we are. Jesus has the keys that open the door to eternal bliss. Not this material stuff we got. It can be really distracting. Eternal bliss. So that's how he introduces himself in the letter. What do I learn from that? Isaiah 43 verse 13 says, "Also henceforth I am he. There is none who can deliver from my hand. I work, and who can turn it back?" Jesus said in John 14 verse 9, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." You must walk past me to get in here, period. If this is all there is, well, enjoy it while it lasts, because it's going downhill from there if you don't know Jesus. What we do with Jesus is the most important decision we could ever make. We've heard that before, I'm sure, but let it sink in. And I think to myself, what I do with Jesus every day matters too. I made a decision. Okay, I'm walking in the right direction. Now can I stay on a course and follow his will every day, one decision at a time? Let's move on to verse 8. I know your works. Did I skip one? It's not on your particular, but I want to stop there just for a moment. Verse 8, I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door. We'll come to that next. Like the other churches, God knew this group of believers, and his communication with them are captured in the phrases that follow. Those things are summarized in the Greek word erga. It's the word translated work. I know your work. And I want to insert something that I learned from that. This has been said to me perhaps thousands of times. You're so judgmental. And let me see if I can explain that in a context. When I was a kid growing up, it just seemed like everybody was judgmental. But once I learned what they were doing, they were looking at the evidence of my life, going, you know, you need to change your ways. They were constantly evaluating everything I said, every attitude I manifested, everything I did. Constantly evaluated. Now, that can be overwhelming sometimes. And I can see how somebody who's used to the exact opposite environment, everybody gets a trophy, everybody came in first place, et cetera, et cetera. That's the swing of the whole pendulum in the opposite direction. So he says, the Spirit says, I know your works. I have this discerning eye, and I can see exactly what you said. I heard exactly what you said. I saw what you did, and I know your attitudes. So part of me says, okay, I can't see everything. I can't know everything, et cetera, et cetera. I certainly can't know what's going on inside of your heart. But there's lots of evidence. And so I try to skillfully evaluate that evidence. What can I see? What am I hearing? What do I discern in that attitude, that tone of voice? So part of me says these words, my works, my deeds, my actions are not isolated. They flow from my heart. They can be designed to deceive but generally they flow from my heart and point to an attitude, to my attitudes and my values. They are not definitive, but they do point in a certain direction, and as human beings, we should watch our actions and choose things that honor God. Our impulsive responses to life often point to what's in our heart. And that's really important. Our impulsive responses to what's going on right now is the most important thing that comes out of us. The when Jesus was sitting in front of 4,000 Gentiles, he turned to Philip and said, let's feed these people. What was Philip's immediate response? What? We've got a couple of fish and some loaves of bread. This is impossible. Yeah, well, are you out of your mind? He's talking to God, by the way. That was his internal response. And Jesus doesn't beat him up over that. He said, well, bring him over here. Let's pray over it. And off they went. So the situations of life present us with these obstacles sometimes, et cetera, et cetera. But God knows us by our hearts and by our actions, and it's not judgmental to observe and take notes. God does, but he knows it all. I only know what I perceive. And so as we cast our ideas about us and so forth, etc., the closer the person is to you, the more judgmental you can be. Your children, you know what? That's not good right there. You need to stop doing that. I was talking with Lisa before church, and she's sitting in a classroom. Those aren't your children, but they are your students. So that's another relationship. Well, how much authority do I have to speak into their life? Well, you got to be careful in some environments, etc. I taught in the school when all the children stood up when I walked in the classroom. That's completely unheard of today for 9 straight years. High school kids to junior high kids stood up when any adult walked in the classroom. Okay, you know, I still had some rowdy ones, etc. You have to kind of get on top of. So I know your works is a pretty powerful statement. We'll only read it one more time in the next letter. But let's move on. This open door assures their access to God and then success at leading others to him. Let's go back into verse 8. I have set before you an open door which no one is able to shut. I know that you have but little power, and yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. This is a very positive thing because God has opened a door for them, and it remains open because God keeps it open, which nobody is able to shut. So what is he talking about, first of all? He's first of all talking about their access to him. I'm not safe because God puts open doors in front of me. I'm safe because God, I have access to God in determining what's going on with those doors. Am I going to walk through that door? Am I going to walk away from that door? What am I going to do? God can give me specific direction on what to do next. You have access to me, lock, stock, and barrel. Come join us. Secondly, if God's the one who opens doors, well then, there are people I should talk to, and there are other people I should just, I'll talk to you later. It's just the wrong time. Have you ever talked to witness to somebody and go, that was bad timing? That's happened to me many times. This is not the right time. Or sometimes I need to say something different to crack the door open further. Okay? So, the open door assures our own access to God, and it might lead to success in speaking to other people. What do I learn from that? First, Christ has opened the door of salvation, and no one can close the door. As long as he is waiting and hasn't returned, the door of salvation is wide open. Wide open. Second, God opens doors to share the gospel. And we have access to the throne of grace whenever, wherever we are. Makes no difference. Full, complete access. All right, let's move to the next one. I know you have little power. A little bit further down, verse 8. I know that you have but little power, and yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. He means by that, I realize that you're not a big deal in this town. You really don't have very much influence at all. Maybe where you work, you have no influence on what happens around here. Zero. No one listens to me. Nobody cares what I think. I'm just a little miniature cog in this big, huge wheel. when I was working in City Hall for a little while, that's exactly what I thought, and I was on the city council. There's not a single person in this building who gives a hoot what I think. If I don't vote for that stuff, I'm on the wrong side of the thing. So you get in those situations. No one cares what you think. And God understands that completely. These words point to the position that this little house church has in Philadelphia. They, by comparison to others, are weak in influence as they struggle along in a pagan environment. The more non-Christian the environment, the more difficult it's going to be for you to go, where do I fit into this box right here in terms of the most important things in life? And they're going to say, we want you to do this for us. We don't care what you think about this. There's no reflection on their obedience. They have kept my words and have not denied my name. That's okay. Your influence is not, it's just what you, whatever you have. Just obey me and walk in my ways, and I will open doors. Quietly, someone will tap you. I have said to my children and to people I care deeply about and church members and stuff like that, just be a faithful employee who helps the owners become successful, and God will open doors for you for the most important things. Will you get promoted? I don't know. Will you point someone to Christ? Almost guaranteed. You will have an opportunity to point someone in the right direction for Christ's sake. So what do I learn? The situations of life can be very disappointing. They can cause us to reverse course or even worse, quit. But these believers have not done either. They have pressed forward, believing that God has a blessed future for them. They do that by simply obeying God, by choosing the best path forward and working in accordance with his word. They intend to do what they can by for the glory of God, and they leave the results to God. If we stress about the results, God's going to, you're on your own. I'm not going to help you with that. Don't stress about the results. Just do what he wants us to do. Share with people. If they reject you, okay. Don't stress about the results. I knew a pastor in Alaska, and this is a true story. He pastors a small church in central Alaska, and I was talking with one of his leadership people who I was really good friends with. That guy's parents came to our church, and he said, you know, Mark, our pastor has spent the entire year trying to win one person to Christ, and he is so disappointed, he resigned last week. What? Over one person, he just resigned? Yep. He put all of his efforts into that one person, and it wasn't time. God didn't save that person. He didn't open his heart. He got so unhappy about that. How is that possible? He did. I talked to him once, and he was just disappointed that God didn't save that person. You're not in charge of the results. You can't make God do something. So leave the results to God. And he's telling this church the same thing. You have little power, but that's okay. Just obey me. Just do what I ask you to do. Walk in that direction. I see a little bit of that in us, in this for us. This is the way in thinking of a faithful believer. Let's read the next verse 9 and 10. Behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan, who say they are Jews and are not, but lie, behold, I will make them come and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. I will make them. Like, that's an interesting statement. Verse 9 in his phrasing tells me that God will vindicate these believers before those who are battling them, the local synagogue. This was a problem in some of these towns. Synagogues were like, they were having some serious problems because these people absconded Judaism, stacked on top of the Old Testament, and introduced this idea of the Messiah. And they're going, wait, Jesus wasn't the Messiah. So they would get into these really nasty battles with each other locally. Twice in this verse we find the Greek word, which indicates that God is working. He's actually making something happen. He's placing things in their place so that things come the way he wants them to come out. The people in the synagogue say one thing, but God is in charge and what he desires will take place. They will bow and submit to the notion that God loves the church. And the people who will bow and acknowledge this are the biological Jews, people of the synagogue, who are battling the church that God now loves. He places love on the church. In verse 10, we read, I will keep from a word, I will preserve, watch over, and protect these people. God will respond to the endurance of these believers with protection and preservation. I'm in charge. I'm working this project, and I will see to it. Look at verse 10. But you have kept my word about patient endurance. I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world to try those who dwell on the earth. I'm going to protect you. Whatever may come, I'm going to take care of you. That's good news. The patient endurance will lead to protection from future trouble that is coming from God. What do I learn? I may not get relief from the issues that plague my life, but I will be free from the judgment that is coming to those around me that live in a rebellion against God and his ways. I don't ever speak on this topic, but it comes to mind. The prosperity gospel says if you do this, God's going to richly bless your life. Really? That's just not true. I know numerous Christians who lived an upright, godly life, and they just eke out a living and kind of hobble along from time to time. They might have a good day or two, and it's just hard. I was at my reunion, and I told my fellow classmates, you know, my parents had 7 children, and at one time, my father had 7 children in Christian school at one time for 2 straight years. I went, how does anybody who makes $6,000 a year pay for that? I have no idea. We never had 2 cars. We never had a new car. It was always some used, rambling station wagon. We never went on vacation because we couldn't get everything in the car. But they were faithful people. And I have no doubt that I'll see him again. They just did what God told them to do. They didn't educate us. They put us in Christian schools for that distinct purpose. I take that to imply that I may not get relief from the issues that plague my life, that come to me because of my present stand against present wrong, but I will be free of the judgment that is coming to those around me that defy God and live in rebellion. My reward's not down here. It just isn't. I live for a much, much more spectacular eternal reward. He says, in the Old Testament, that day was called the Day of the Lord. And it included punishment not only for God's enemies, but enemies in the camp of Israel. You don't want to get caught in the day of the Lord when God comes down to punish the earth and the wickedness that's going on. In the Old Testament, we read about a period called Great Tribulation, and they will be free from that hour of trouble on the earth. They will be snatched away. There's no guarantee that trouble in this life will be avoided by a Christian lifestyle. Please understand that correctly. There is no guarantee that a Christian lifestyle will result in a pleasant life. No guarantee of that. But if we choose to walk with God, the future could not be more spectacular. The worst location in heaven, if there's such a thing, is vastly better than anything that's ever happened down here. Trust me. Because we live in a season of history where the devil seems to be in charge and on a rampage, at times we need to hear these words and choose a strong heart to endure and remain steadfast. We are called to give up, to never give up, to endure until the return of Jesus Christ. Don't ever give up. As ugly as things can get, and things can get ugly, and we've had this discussion a few times in prayer meeting recently, how bad can it really get? And we think in this environment, oh, this is really bad. You have seen nothing yet, trust me. I've been in third world countries 7 or 8 times, and it's like, how could people survive in this environment? It's awful. The last place I was in Bhutan, a complete 99% Buddhist country, and you can't have a church in that country. So when we snuck around, the lady where we were staying in the hotel said, "What are you guys doing here anyway? Should we just lie to this lady?" Kind of dismissed the question. She kind of knew, these guys aren't here pushing Buddhism. She knew. Just an awful environment. We met some interesting people. What does he say? Hold what you have. Look at verse 11. I am coming soon. Hold fast what you have so that no one may seize your crown. This phrase is wrapped up in 3 Greek words. They are to hold on to what they have. Another way of thinking about that, faith in Jesus Christ and obedience to his word will ensure that you don't give up your crown. It's a description of what it means to patiently endure. He mentioned that earlier. Just be patient and endure. That's an interesting phrase. We'll touch on that in a moment. One commentator said, so that you will without question receive what is waiting for you. Think about this. Something is waiting for us. And God goes, I can't wait to give it to you. Just endure patiently. And, you're not going to believe how good this is going to be. Just patiently endure. The point is not that they could lose it, but rather they are encouraging words that prompt them to be greater endurance for the prize that awaits them, a crown that points to and celebrates their endurance through all the trouble. A couple of things. First of all, what do I learn about patient endurance? First of all, it just takes so long. Think about this. This letter was written in probably 99, 100 AD, somewhere in there. And Jesus has been gone for 60 years. It's like, oh my goodness, they're thinking, what is taking so long? And here we are 2,000 years later, or whatever, going, oh, this is how long it takes. And could Jesus return anytime soon? I don't know. What would make him take so long? This is a long wait. In the case of the early believers, they thought Jesus would return soon. That's what it says in the text. This is all coming to an end soon. He's kind of scratching his head going, really? Here we are 1,900 years later. It's still soon? I just read the words. So patient endurance is this, it just takes forever. I've waited for about 20 minutes and been out of my mind. It's like, come on, let's go. I've been in doctor's offices and waited for 45 minutes and thought, I'm getting out of here. I'm done with this nonsense. So years would be insane. Okay? There's a second thing in here, and it may be a person's calling. Do you know someone who just, their life is just one trial after the next? It's like this person has an endless list of things. It's like, oh my goodness. It feels like this little church, he's saying, right now this is your calling. Right now, my sister, she's taken a permanent job at Bob Jones High School, and she's the permanent substitute. And she said, there's a kid in the high school. Only thing he can do is talk. Nothing moves. He's got some paralysis. He's in a wheelchair. But he is easily the smartest person in the state. He's just a genius. But he needs someone as a personal aide all day long. And so she's thinking, who in the world would want to do that? So she calls this woman up, and she's a biochemist, I think she is. And, I'll be glad to do it. She doesn't tell her anything about the student. It's just, it's a one-on-one. So, okay, the person's developmentally disabled or whatever. I'll be glad to help out. This is a biochemist. It's a really smart lady. And so she introduces her to the student, et cetera. She follows the student around all day. And she comes in the office at the end of the day. What do you think she said? I have not been so blessed in my whole life. This kid is, I will do this every day for the rest of the year. Now there's an individual, I'm not sure I would see it that way. There's an individual who says, this is my calling in life. I didn't pick this, I would never pick this, but I will make the very best out of this, and everybody who's coming with me, they're going to enjoy the ride. That takes an amazing person. He's calling us to that. And we got things good. First Peter chapter 4 says, Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trials when it comes upon you to test you as though something strange were happening to you. This is strange. No, it's common. It happens to people. But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. And then Peter has this close friend, and John probably knew him just as well, James. He writes, Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. So I'm grateful that I don't have a calling to suffer and just have a miserable, difficult existence. But praise God for people who walk through that faithfully and bring for the glory of God. All right. A pillar in the temple of my God. Look at verse 12 and 13. I'll read those closing verses. And the one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it, and I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God and the new Jerusalem, which comes down from God, my God, out of heaven, and my own new name. So instead of having your name written on a pillar in one of those pagan temples, which was common in the city of Philadelphia, God will actually give you a pillar in his temple. You don't get your name on a pillar, you get your own whole pillar. It's yours. And he writes his name on your pillar. That's really an interesting flip. And if you go to the end of the book of Revelation, what does his temple look like? There is no temple in there. You're the pillars of it, you and I. So he's encouraging these people. We're going to flip this thing around completely. Okay, some of your friends got their names on the pillars in those stupid temples. I got a better idea. The one who remains steadfast and patient will have a pillar in God's temple, not some pagan temple in town, but in God's temple, the New Jerusalem. And I will write my name on their pillar. That's God saying, he's mine. He belongs to me. I will take care of his future forever. I will write my name, write on him the name of my God, the city of my God, my own name. That's God going, he's with me. Stamp it. He's trying to encourage his church. So what do I learn from that? Let's close this thing out. My spiritual inheritance is all of Christ's and is all only from Christ. It is a gift to me, and whatever doubts I may have in no way affects this gift. It's interesting. I've worked, when I was a Baptist, I worked the altar from time to time, and people would come down. And the truth of the matter is they weren't truly sure if they were Christians. They were doubting their salvation. So the question is that a God issue or is that a me issue? I'd walk them through the story of their salvation, etc. Okay, that sounds like that's what God told you to do. So what's the issue? I wasn't crass like that with them, but helping them understand this is you, this is an issue inside of you. So what is it that creates doubts inside of us about, am I truly a child of God? And I would suggest to you that there are two things. I didn't put this on your notes, but let me tell you what they are. First of all, personal sin. If you nurture and don't deal with the sin in your life, if you don't keep short accounts, guess what? It builds up doubts inside of you in regards to your relationship with God. Every time. You hate to ask somebody that question. Well, is there something you've been doing that you probably shouldn't be doing? Because those things get in the way. Why do you think David wrote Psalm 51? He knew that what he did with Bathsheba was between him and God. He was clueless about it the whole time. When he recognized it, oh my goodness, I got to resolve this problem. I don't care who knows what's going on. I need to solve this problem. Sin gets between us and God, and it builds up massive amounts of doubt inside of us. If I know what I should be doing and I'm not doing it, that's just the playground for the devil. I'll stop there and move on to number two. Number two is a little more subtle. Battering rhetoric that I begin to own that really has no application to my life. What I listen to, the voices I entertain in my head, the negative feedback that dominates my downtime can leave me wondering and questioning God. This is of the devil, and we need to turn from those voices and hear the words of the Lord. I read an interesting article this past week about a girl in England who killed herself because of social media. Her parents are suing social media. So she's listening to all this negative nonsense. Okay, let me tell you a little story. This is important to me. I was in my first Alliance Church, and I went to a district conference, and my mentor was there. I'm not sure why he was there, but I figured it out later. He said to me on the way to some meeting, "Hey, Mark, let's get together for lunch one of these days. We're here." I said, "Okay." So we met for lunch in this cavernous room, up on the third floor, in this new building. And we walked in there. There was no chairs or tables in there. It was just the two of us, Don and me. And he says, "Mark, I want to ask you a question. If God walked through that door right there, Jesus Christ walked through that door, what would he say to you?" What? I kind of looked at him like, "This is a trick question. Just answer the question, Mark. Come on. What would God say to you?" So my mind's going, he'd give me a B+. He looked at me like, "What? He would not. Try that again." I said, I came up with some similar type answer. I go, "Okay, you tell me what God would say." He says, "I'll tell you what he would say. He walked out that door, came through that door, and said, 'Mark, my beloved son, how are you?'" I just started crying. How did I even miss that? Simple. Too many negative voices. All this negative feedback, people saying all this stuff, "You need to do this, et cetera, et cetera." And I never hear the voice of God saying those important words to me. "You are my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. You're not perfect. Everybody knows that. But you are my son." If you're a mom, don't you feel that way about your kids no matter what they've done? "That's my kid." That's how God feels about every one of us. He wants his name is stamped on us. "You are my beloved son in whom I am well pleased, and I place my name on you. You are mine, and I am working in you to conform you to the image of all my glory." Okay? Conclusions. Number one, it is ironic that God's chosen people, Israel, are to be wooed back to Jehovah via the Gentiles. We live in that age. He's using us to woo his people back to him. And they are the people before whom the Jews will bow. Romans chapter 11 describes the Gentiles as coming into the family of God because of the Jews' trespasses. Paul writes, "For if God did not spare the natural branches, neither will he spare you, provided you continue in his kindness. Otherwise, you too will be cut off." Romans chapter 11, verse 21, 22. Okay. Second. Some will have it much worse than others, and when we learn of that, we can do our part to relieve their pain and encourage them in their struggle. But the end will be different from the present or the past. There are some issues I've listened to as a pastor. It's like, oh, my soul. How did that happen? Just ruthless nonsense, just evil lurking in the backgrounds, et cetera, et cetera. All you can do is encourage people. Walk with them in the trauma and encourage them to remain faithful to God. So that's all he's doing in this letter. You folks have, you're good. Be faithful. And third, question that comes to mind is, this is the second time in these letters that the Jewish community is mentioned. What should the New Testament do with unbelieving Jews, and how should we feel towards them and the position that we now enjoy? Here's my answer. We are of the Jews. Our Redeemer was Jewish. God first loved the Jewish people, and God is not done with the Jews. That's what the book, that's what Romans tells me, Romans chapter 11. God is not finished with the Jews. So how I treat the Jews does matter. Are they perfect? No, they're not. Trust me, they're not. Romans chapter 11 warns the New Testament church to honor the Jews without backing down to their incomplete gospel and missing Messiah. There was a famous minister who was being interviewed by Ben Shapiro, a famous Jewish guy in our country. And what did he talk to that guy about? It's brilliant. Isaiah 53. Right in your face, buddy. And poor Ben, he did right over his head. Smart a guy as he is, blew right over his head. That's what we do. We bring them to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. Church of Philadelphia is a good place. It didn't have a lot of influence in town, but boy, oh boy, God has some good things to tell them, to remind us about. My mind is stuck on, you are my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. I remember leaving that particular little moment in my ministry life and telling myself, don't you ever forget to tell your kids that. One at a time, personal. I'm not a perfect dad, you're not a perfect kid, but you are my beloved son, my beloved daughter, and I could not be more pleased that God picked you to be mine. That's how God feels about us. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word, for the encouragement that it has for us. Remind us today that we are your beloved children, and you have staged the future to take us home. I pray that we'll be reminded about that today. We'll be encouraged by that today. And you will speak to us by your Spirit so that we know that we are your children. Bless your word, Lord. Bless our week. Pray for John as he heads over to get Linda, her parents. Bring them back safely. Perhaps we'll get to meet them. I pray that you will be a blessing to them as they travel there and back. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.